Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, hopefully this evening our special guest is going to be Constance Cumby, who had a profound impact on my own life back in the early 1980s when I had been studying at that time what was going on in the world for about 20 years. And I knew all about communism, and communism threatened the world. At least I believed that. I believed communism was a wicked and it was the enemy. Now, communism was very wicked, but as you begin to study it, you realize what was hardly the enemy when it was a failed system that was being kept in power with massive grants of money from the West in the form of financing their technology, financing their banks, financing their industries, giving them massive loans, and, well, suddenly that's rather disheartening. Even here in the United States, where we had, of course, this threat of communists in our government, we found that the domestic Communist Party and Socialist Movement were being financed by our great tax-exempt foundation. So it appeared that they, perhaps, were the real enemy. And then it was in the early 1980s, I read a book called The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. It was written by our guest this evening, and it talked about the occult movement. It talked about the influence of the Masons and the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians and this so-called New Age movement. And you could find a New Age bookstore right in my downtown area, and there it was, and they had all sorts of books on these other views, these books that told stories of a different spirituality, different than the Christian message at all. And so I began studying that as well. Of course, I've learned a lot through the years, but I still am always amazed by the information that Constance has to bring us up to keep us informed about what's really going on behind the scenes. So it's late back in Michigan where Constance practices law. Constance Cumby, thank you so much for being with us again tonight.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Well, I understand you've been on, is it Israeli National Radio?
I did an interview for Israel National Radio. It was the Tamar Yona show, and it was at the end of the first New Year's Day in Michigan, and it would have been the start of the January 2nd in Israel, the start of their business day. And that was, I did an hour interview, and they still have it available for download up on the Internet, I believe. And they've asked me to do another one this coming Sunday morning.
Well, obviously, you know, of course, they're coming from a Jewish point of view. You're coming from a Christian point of view.
Right.
When they start putting Christians on Israeli radio, why, we know that something big is afoot.
Yes. Well, I think they've had other Christians on before, but they did give this one much more play. It was not at all a hostile interview, and they definitely were convinced. The discernment on it was amazing. Looked like they had actually prepared for the interview and were familiar with the material and shared my concerns.
Well, I think everybody should share your concerns, because it's impossible to understand what's going on in the Middle East today or what's going on in Washington, D.C., or all the contradictions of everything that's going on if you stop and think about it, unless you realize there's this X factor that you write so extensively
about.
Well,
what our common denominator was on it was the Alliance of Civilization.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Constance Cumby, and we'll be talking about the Alliance of Civilizations and so many other things associated with the world occult movement that is dominating so much of what's taking place in the world today. Well, Constance, you pick up the story there.
Okay. Well, I was pleasantly surprised to receive the invitation, and to tell the truth, it was a miracle that I responded to it, because there is so much email in my box I tell people it's okay to email me, but it might be a good idea to call me and tell me you've emailed me so I can go do a search in the box. And one Sunday morning, I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, which was unusually early and unwelcome. And I finally, I gave up and went out and opened my email, which is even more unusual for me on a weekend. It's too much like work during the week. And sitting right at the top was an invitation to do a program on Israel National Radio in approximately 3 days. And I thought if I hadn't gotten up then, there would have been so many messages in the box that I would have missed the invitation and had let it fly right by me. But the concern was the Alliance of Civilizations, the attempt. I had written an article for NewsWithViews.com entitled The Alliance of Civilizations, War on Monotheistic Religions, and had pointed out quotes from these theosophically inspired books by Alice Ann Bailey. That I had a passage from the Raising the Initiations that Jerusalem stands for nothing except for three dead and gone religions that are dying and deserve to pass away, and she'd referred to the Jews, Christians, and Muslims and the New Age strategy of pitting all three against each other so that they would basically pit the fundamentalists of each group off against the fundamentalists of the other group, and then proselytize the others that would not be as rigid in their theologies, and then they would basically move in for the kill. The New Agers would be the phoenix that would arise from the ashes and build the new society. And I had backing up as documentation the actual Alliance of Civilizations report that had come down from the United Nations, which called for registering all religious schools worldwide, so subjecting all the curriculums to scrutiny. And I had noted in my article that if this did in fact take place, it would bring religious freedom planet-wide to a crashing halt. And they saw this, and they were very concerned themselves. Was there a global attempt afoot to build a new world religion, which of course there is, and basically it's termites from within, wrecking balls from without, and it's okay to have a religion in the new world order. It's just not okay to believe that your religion is true unless you believe Sai Baba is God, Maitreya is the Christ, or Reverend Moon is the Lord of the Second Advent.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Constance was just saying that because she had written an article that appeared in NewsWithViews.com, and I suggest you go and get it and pull it down, talking about this overall plan that comes out the writings of Alice Bailey, who was a Luciferian, talking about how they were going to actually come up with this idea of turning the three religions one against the other, get them all fighting, and then out of the destruction that would result from the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians fighting, then there would come this new world order and this new world religion that they dream of, and they, being the New Age or the Luciferians who were really behind this whole occult movement, would then come to be in charge of the world. So pick the story up there.
Okay, well, I had noted also in my article that the European Union and in general, and Javier Solana in particular, was behind this, although he was hiding behind a couple of other players. And they were concerned about this because one of the leading Israeli politicians had made a speech just about 2 or 3 days before we did the radio interview calling for Israel to join the European Union. And they had pointed out that they thought religions needed to be suppressed and that we... And she said, well, if we're not going to trust these issues, she said, if we can't trust religions on these, who are we going to trust if we can't have religious beliefs? And this was an Israeli comment that was very astute. She said, politicians? We're going to let politicians decide morals if religious people aren't good enough to do it? And it was, but any rate, there was, we were looking at some very common elements, and then I was pleasantly surprised that there were callers very well educated on the New Age movement with concerns about it, and called in and were even warning about some of the facets of it that had hit the medical field, particularly in the holistic health area. And so it was kind of a sobering time. I never in my life thought I would have an opportunity to talk to Israel about this, and especially on an international hookup. And they kept it up for several weeks and also kept it up in the Herat Shiva news, the internet news, and had links to it and gave links back to my blog spot. So that was an amazing, amazing opportunity, and which one made me think that perhaps if that many doors are opening for us, that the times must be getting very serious indeed. And which reminds me, I don't know if you perused the news today about my very good friend, I'm speaking a little facetiously, Javier Solana.
No, I didn't see it. Well, what's he up to now?
Well, he gave a speech today, and it's just brand new. This is hot off the press. Solana calls for creating trust in international relations. He's blamed the deficit of trust for many problems facing the international community. He said what the current system often lacks is trust among the relevant players. Trust is the basis of everything. Its absence cripples the international society and may lead to sometimes tragic misunderstandings, he said in a speech. This is a speech he gave in New York City at the Arthur Burns Memorial Dinner. He said, I see a deficit of trust in several areas between the West and the Muslim world. The cartoon crises in Palestine are vivid proof. He said, by the way, the Muslim world also exists within our own cities, between the have-nots and the haves. There is a growing tension around the world between the disarmament and the non-proliferation side of the coin, between energy consumers and suppliers, look at the current scramble for energy, or at how Russia, Algeria, Iran are flirting with a gas OPEC option, said the EU foreign policy chief. His speech was distributed to the press in Brussels, and then he said, how can we address these trust deficits, basically? He said, I believe we need to think about new bargains, for example, on the environment, or on forms of dialogues between cultures. That's the Alliance of Civilizations again, that basically was started at his initiative. He said, we may need to be more serious about upholding our side of old bargains, for instance on disarmament, if we want to remain credible when we rightly challenge those that openly break the non-proliferation rules. Above all, we need to revive the view of politics as the art of building trust where it does not exist. This is the first step. The second is to create fair and clear rules and strong institutions to apply them. We will need to apply them to navigate the choppy waters of the next 50 years, said Solana. And it was a speech that said, trust me.
Well, I think that for our listeners out there who do not know who Javier Solana is, he is a Spanish Marxist who is probably the most powerful man in the world today. A little known, but he holds key positions with both Western European military and the Western European. Is he in the Western European Parliament? What is this?
He is the head of the Western European Union.
He is, okay.
He headed the Western European Union. Was supposedly the net 10-nation European Federation, and its 10 permanent members have weighted voting power in the European Union Council, the European Union as well. And his first position after leaving NATO, which he headed as Secretary General for close to 4 years, was to be the Secretary General of the European Union and the Office of the High Representative for the Common Foreign and Security Policy for the European Union. And then approximately 5 weeks after he left to take that job on November 20th, 1999, it was announced that the 10-nation Western European Union had decided to hand their power to Javier Solana for their last year of operation. That's a year that's lasted a long time, because he hasn't dissolved it. It's just too bully a pulpit. And so he's head of the Secretary General of the Western European Union, as well as Secretary General of the European Union. The Western European Union is a military federation, and much of your military planning takes place under that, and also something called European Security and Defense Policy. And he keeps it open, and they have all kinds of planning meetings, and when something's stymied and frustrated, in the European Union because they can't agree. He has the Western European Union to fall back on.
For our listeners, he was the man who made the decision that the United States would bomb, or at least NATO would bomb, Kosovo during the Clinton administration. He was the one who went to see Mr. Olmert, Premier Olmert of Israel during the Lebanon War, and told him to pull his troops out of Lebanon. And, and Mr. Olmert said the premier of Israel immediately carried out the instructions. Here is the man, little known, and yet he seems to be one of the invisible rulers of the world.
We've joked around the office. We've sometimes called him the invisible man, that we're about the only ones that see him, because his name is everywhere. It's out there. Some days, any day, given day, there's between 1,500,000 and 8 million Google hits on him, and always a couple thousand in the news at least. And yet people seem to miss him. When the bombing started on, was about to start on Kosovo, Javier Solana had been given sole authority to make the decision as to whether and when and if it would happen and for how long. And when President Clinton went on national television to talk about it, he never said, this is what I think we should do, this is what we think we should do, or even this is what the heads of the world community think we should do, which would be bad enough. Instead, he said, I agree with Javier Solana's decision to do this. And nobody said, who's Javier Solana?
And, of course, where did that 666, decree 666?
Oh, yes. His job was created, Section 666 of the Europa Code. That's the official document number. It was enacted in December of 1998 while Solana was still at NATO. They obviously wrote the specifications around him, and his job was created, ahead of the Secretary General of the European Union and head of the CFSP, Common Foreign and Security Policy, with Section 666 of the Europa Code, and that was the European Union. And in the Western European Union, he introduced a bill, Recommendation 666, wherein he proposed that he be given emergency powers over Europe and power to convene the Council of the European Union in the event of an emergency, and control over the police powers of Europe. And that was given him in December of 2000 in Nice, France. He introduced the bill June 5th of 2000 in the Western European Union Assembly, and made the ten nations there plus the other 18 auxiliary members of that assembly pledge that they would give their support to this in the European Union itself, which did take place later that year. And so, curiously enough, maybe he plays a lot of Yahtzee and he likes the numbers because of that. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
What?
As deficient as his religious education may have been, he had to have known something of the symbolism of the number 666 to the Christian community.
Well, he is certainly one of those shadowy figures, and yet, fortunately, consciousness is keeping abreast of him.
But he doesn't look shadowy. He looks like everybody's favorite professor, the most comfortable pair of old shoes in your closet, like somebody you and I would buy a used car from and feel very safe doing it.
We have to ask, though, why would simply a professor suddenly be one of the most, probably the most powerful political figure in the world? I mean, how do you get from being a professor to being such a prominent political figure? It's almost like there is an invisible force behind it.
Very, and I'm certain there is. Well, his mother was a disciple of the guru, occult guru, and from Oregon, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. His grandfather was very close. Alice Bailey and Olga Freeby Captain thought many times to have his grandfather come and speak to their Institute for Spiritual Research at Ascona, Switzerland, and his grandfather was out giving talks about the hope for implementation of the New World Order back in the late 30s.
His grandfather
also said that the United States was absolutely ineligible to lead this New World Order or to play any type of leadership in the world because of the Monroe Doctrine.
Well, we're living in exciting times. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Our guest is Constance Cumby. Have you come across this new DVD and motion picture that's come out that's been featured now twice on the Oprah Winfrey Show and is really sweeping the nation? They claim that somewhat less than a million copies have been sold. It's called The Secret?
No.
Oh, you're going to have to go. You'll go wild when you go out of the way, under the internet, and look up The Secret. And it came from Australia. It basically says that there is a secret. It's been around since the beginning of time, and certainly all the prominent people have known about it, whether it be Einstein or certainly Leonardo da Vinci or Plato or all the great philosophers, all the great world leaders have known about it. And, of course, this is how you really learn how to tap into the secret power.
One world leader who probably has that according to books an author you and I are both familiar with, Wayne Peterson.
Right.
He says that Gorbachev has been an open devotee of this for a very long time.
No question at all. In fact, Wayne Peterson and people. Wayne Peterson was a high official in our own government. He said that people are from all over the world are congregating now in Las Vegas, waiting for the world leader who is going to mysteriously appear in Las Vegas.
Oh, okay.
Have you read? I'm sure you must have read
Wayne Peterson's
book.
The book is called Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary right. Beings: Experiences right. of an American Diplomat with Maitreya and the Masters of Wisdom. And this fellow is really a far-out true believer. And he talked about Gorbachev and Gorbachev's openness on this. And what's interesting to me, a very interesting connection, is that Wayne Peterson was an administrator of the Fulbright Scholarship, and Javier Solana was a Fulbright Scholar.
Well, of course, once you connect all the dots, you begin to realize that there's this other world out there. There are people who have a different worldview. And many of these people do tap into this so-called cosmic consciousness. And I do believe that there is a tremendous power that you can get by doing that, but you do at the risk of your eternal soul.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And there are many planks on it that are one of the most spiritually frightening planks of this entire agenda is earth worship. And I have wondered many days. Time and events will tell what's right down the road. But I have wondered many days if the image of the prophesied image of the beast in the scriptures was not the whole earth itself, the picture of the earth, that they made everybody make this image to the beast, and that those that wouldn't suffered these penalties, including death. Because the New Agers have been saying, as long as I've been looking at them, that they now have their image, which is the whole earth itself. But the more and more militantly every day, earth worship is being trotted out as one of the pillars of the... Well, it's the Earth Charter itself is touted as a pillar of the Alliance of Civilizations. And I had some emails from Israel as a result of the program I was on, and said that they were suspecting that maybe their prophesied abomination of desolation in Daniel could even be the Earth Charter and the Earth Covenant.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Constance Cumby, and Constance was just talking about the Earth Charter, which, of course, is sort of the master plan for the world. In fact, if you read occult literature, they often refer to the plan, and the P in plan is always capitalized. And it was her suggestion that the Earth Charter, which was written by Gorbachev, Marie Strong, and the son of Nelson Rockefeller, Dr. Stephen Rockefeller, mm-hmm. they have written what Gorbachev and Marie Strong call the new Ten Commandments for the world, that's kept in something called the Ark of Hope, which is a Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes, and it's a blatant play on the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. So do you think that the Earth Charter could perhaps be the master plan that the New Agers have been talking about?
Well, I think it's part of their package. I think there is more to it than just the Earth Charter, but they certainly are moving very, very aggressively in that direction, and basically saying that we have to have this new shared vision. If we're going to preserve the Earth for future generations, we have to have a new shared vision, that we have to have reverence for the Earth, that we have to adopt this Gaian perspective, G-A-I-A, and that's another very abominable belief that the Earth is a living goddess that deserves worship and respect. And I think that this may be one of the most pivotal lines for salvation that there is. And I'll tell you why, if I may.
Go right ahead.
Revelation chapter 14, Apocalypse to our Catholic listeners, says, "Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. Worship God who created the heaven, the earth, the sea, and the fountains of waters." This is doing just the opposite. This is calling for everybody to worship everything but the good Lord who created it. In fact, the rash of books that are coming out now mocking Christian belief and labeling us all as fascists, such as Chris Hedges' book, American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America, but he goes much further, and he obviously has been close to Javier Solana. In fact, he uses the same words describing Christians that Solana does, that we're thinking in binary terms. He was the correspondent for the New York Times in Kosovo, which would have put him in contact. But the language, the nature of the attacks and the viciousness of the attacks, which has made Mr. Solana even look polite, and even had some Muslims crying out, protesting how hard he was on American Christians, that's saying, well, that's no more fair to label all of them than it is to label all of us. He's praising this form of earth worship, and they're ridiculing Christians that are trying to keep their child from it. Now, this is critical because there was a scriptural warning that if any man worshiped the beast or his image, that they would suffer the everlasting wrath of God, that they would be tormented forever in the presence of God and the holy angels. And that's a line that we dare not cross. It's like we'd crossed Eve's line again, only worse.
Well, I really do believe that we are entering the prophesied time. Certainly everything would point in that direction. Obviously, they're doing everything they can to get the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews of the world into a world war. Mm-hmm. And out of that, the horrible consequences of that, why would come this new world order?
And that's what Alice Bailey said, that if we didn't all agree on something, then we were headed for a war that would make all dwarf all other wars, and it would be fought with different types of weapons. And basically that's what's going down, and more and more and more religion is being identified as the culprit. There's a book by another propaganda book that I read about on the Alliance of Civilizations website, and it's by a couple also New York Times related, and the wife is a professor at Georgetown University, A World of Flame, and it's a Jewish couple, the Tochins, who lost a son tragically to cystic fibrosis, for which I'm sympathetic. I lost three cousins to cystic fibrosis. But they basically were obviously writing a propaganda book for the Alliance of Civilizations and to stir up the public sentiment of need in it. And some of the mistakes in it were very amusing. They rushed it out so fast. There were serious mistakes. And one they said that Assalam Salikum was the ambassador to America from Bangladesh. And I know a little bit of Arabic. It's a useful second language here in Detroit. And I looked at that thing and I went, whoa. Assalam Salikum is the name of an ambassador. Assalam Salikum is an Arabic greeting, and which is responded to in the reverse. It's a reciprocal greeting of peace. And I wrote a rather scathing review of it and put it up on the Internet, and they've been kind of quiet about that book since then.
Hold on, we'll be back here in just a moment with the Constance Cumby here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners what the Alliance of Civilizations is? What is this, a master plan, and who's really behind it?
Well, the Javier Solana made initial proposals that something like this had to take place, and then he initially ran it through Zapatero, the socialist prime minister of Spain, the same political party as Javier Solana's, and Tony Blair of England. And then they later came up with a news story that it had been proposed by Khatami of Iran, the former prime minister of Iran, I believe, and who was also a Muslim cleric, and that he had proposed it. It had started with Solana earlier, a few years earlier. And then their news story was that it was introduced, being co-sponsored by Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey and Zapatero of Spain. But it was Solana's. And they proposed, they said, first of all, if we're going to solve the world's problems, we have to solve this religion issue. And basically, we have error in religion, because in thinking that there are any fundamentals, that there are absolute truths, because what religion is about is cross-fertilization and cross-pollination. And what we need to do is have this, we're going to appoint this group of 20 eminent personalities, and that was funneled from, it went from Solana to first Blair and Zapatero, and then Khatami, and then Blair, Zapatero, and Erdogan, and then Kofi Annan, then said he was in, appointing in the United Nations a group of 20 eminent personalities. And they included people such as Karen Armstrong, the former Catholic nun who left the faith and became very much a syncretist into all the world, great world religions, as she put it, and mixing them up. And 19 others, and people willing to sell out from about every faith, and political figures such as, I think, Federico Meyer, who was from Spain, was a major player. And then they gave them a date to come up with certain recommendations. They had preliminary meetings where Lucis Trust was well represented. And Lucis Trust, in fact, has proposed that that the Alliance of Civilizations could profitably use as the New World Prayer, the Great Invocation. And their recommendations, including building temples around the world and shrines to the Alliance of Civilizations, having these visible physical objects and controlling religious sites.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Constance. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've just been talking about this Alliance for Civilizations, and I'm going to have Constance tell you a lot more about this, because this is a very powerful movement in the world today. The enemies of freedom, the enemies of Christianity, really are intent upon destroying the Christian influence in this world. They have a plan, a master plan. Of course, they intend to destroy all religions and then unite, of course, the remnants of them into this one great religion who will be ruled by the false prophet. But before we get into that, Constance, I wanted you to actually tell people how they can get in touch with your blog site, how they can get some of your information.
Okay, well, I've been sick this week, so my blog spot's been a little quieter than usual. I mean, I was also irritated at Adobe Acrobat has done to one of my computers, so I did a little more talking about that. Javier Solana had a little break this week. But my blog spot is worldwideweb.cumbey.blogspot.com, and then also I write occasionally columns for newswithviews.com also, but when I write those, I tend to put them up on my own blog spot as well. So
all right, fine. So that's how you would get Constance's writings, and of course her book, Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. We have probably the last supply of this, and we'll be talking to you later about perhaps helping us get that reprinted. But her book, Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, what are they? They must have put out hundreds of thousands.
Well, there were Toledo Blade was told back in 1988. The Toledo Blade called me and told them Huntington House that it had sold 600. 6,000 copies. I'll never know the correct amount because varying statements were given. There were foreign editions. It did well in all the countries where it was printed. Germany, there's a German edition, a Norwegian edition, a Dutch edition. And the book did very well. There was, in fact, well enough that a top advisor to Prince Philip and Queen Elizabeth in England, Martin Palmer, who doesn't like me very well, wrote a 1993 book attacking me, and he gave me more ink than practically any other book ever has. And then he said he'd given that much attention to me because my book was the first to come from that stable of Christianity. Of course, the Internet gave me a chance to get even, and I stuck a review up on his book, which didn't do too well. My book stayed in print as long as Huntington House was alive, but his book didn't stay in print that long, and I found it on the remainder table of Barnes & Noble, 50% off lowest advertised price, and the lowest advertised price was $2.50, so I got a little stack of it for $1.25 a piece. I wasn't going to buy the book at all until I saw he had given me as much ink as he had. And I stuck up on the Internet, I said, well, I said, since our Lord was born in a stable, I said, I'll take his comment on me coming from that stable of Christianity as a sort of backhanded compliment. And I also noted, I said, well, I suppose his criticism of me means I have no realistic chance of winning the Templeton Prize for no realistic expectation, winning the Templeton Prize for progress in religion, and if I did win it, they can't give it to me at Buckingham Palace.
Well, certainly, Constance was the first person to draw the attention of the Christian community to this occult influence that has permeated not only society as a whole, but has targeted Christianity and the Christian Church, the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the Jewish religion. The trouble is that this really came out in the early 1980s, and most people have forgotten it today, and now, of course, as we see these influences prevalent within the Protestant Church as we begin getting into contemplative prayer and into yoga and into all of these means by which we can experience Christianity. And that's exactly what they want. They want to begin playing mind games with you so that you can open up your mind to this cosmic consciousness, this truly a universal spirit that's out there. And there is a universal spirit out there. And you certainly don't want it coming in.
And I really think that universal spirit, Dr. Stan, and the more I analyzed that and looked at their total emphasis on altered state techniques to get there and where there was going, I'm convinced we're looking at a movement of mass hypnosis and or mass possession.
Now, you're absolutely right. In fact, I talked to a minister's wife today a couple of days ago, told me that so many of the evangelical ministers here in California were down in San Diego getting introduced to these concepts and the labyrinth and meditating on the candles and all these things. And all of these things, I mean, these are the spiritual leaders of our country are getting involved with all of these Middle Eastern and Eastern religious techniques of contacting God, but the trouble is they're not contacting the God of the Bible.
Right. And by the way, I saw something very interesting recently. Somebody pointed to me that there was an article by not Rick Warren, but one of the Eastern McLaren, I believe, is Brian McLaren.
No, he was speaking at this conference that was held in San Diego this week.
But this Brian McLaren was this particular conference, and what made it issue, it was a collection of articles, and they said they thought that this was pretty damning evidence of involvement in the New Age. And I looked at it, and it was way almost beyond New Age. It was Lucis Trust. Lucis Trust had heavy, in fact, almost all the leaders of Lucis Trust had heavy articles in the same compilation, which had been contributions from these people. McLaren's contribution was there, and then also the singer Bono, and his speech was reproduced from the National Prayer Breakfast, and that was an interesting thing. But the compilation, the only two things that looked pseudo-Christian were Bono and McLaren, but they were based in clearly part of the club, and this was as anti-Christian a club as has ever existed. This club was out-and-out-and-out Luciferic New Age.
Well, unfortunately, it's much easier to destroy Christianity from within than from without.
Yes, and there are... when I first came on the scene and they had to do some scrambling, there was a writer by the name of Jeremy Rifkin. Do you remember him?
Oh, sure.
Rifkin wrote a book called The Emerging Order, God in an Age of Scarcity. And he said in there that only the religious impulse was strong enough to put the new order over the top, and that it would be in the name and the spirit of orthodoxy, religious orthodoxy, that this would come to pass. It would be an evangelical movement, and that the religious paradigm would be changed from a fallen dominion theology to a stewardship paradigm. And he made plans. He shamelessly told how to do it, and he wrote another book called Entropy, and he was very, very open with his New Age sources. And then another book he wrote, a sequel to that, was very open with Madame Blavatsky, a treatise, and Bailey, Alice Ann Bailey, David Spangler, and the like. There was just it was unmistakable, total card-carrying New Age. And by the way, he is a theoretician that is widely used in the European Union now by Javier Solana and Prodi of Italy. And he should have been rebuked. The book was so obvious on its face, it should have been decried as a form of paganism, as a form of invited apostasy. And instead it was published by one of the Christian publishing houses, and then it had all these in the paperback edition. It had all these accolades by evangelical leaders, and they were saying things like, good grief, if we don't hurry up and get on board, we're going to miss out on being in the vanguard of this new Protestant Reformation.
I don't think they really want to be on the vanguard of this Reformation, because this is a Reformation not to, simply convict people of their sinfulness and create a third great awakening.
Well, if they don't know the difference between Reformation and deformation, they're in trouble.
I know.
Even religious considerations and considerations of faith aside. And it was much more of a religious deformation than a Reformation.
Even the Council on Foreign Relations flagship magazine, Foreign Affairs, is putting out articles about how they're going to use religion to bring about this new order that they dream of. And they realize, of course, what a force religion is in this world. And so what they've done is they simply changed the message of Christianity. And Christianity, instead of course, convicting each one as sinful individuals who is reliant upon God and needs a Savior, now we are going to save the world. And of course, with Rick Warren's peace plan, and Rick Warren has joined the Council on Foreign Relations, goes back and talks to them, and he is mobilizing Christians across America. We are going to bring the kingdom of God to earth.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yes. Well, they're bringing a kingdom to earth, and it's not God's kingdom. It's neither godly nor is it of God.
Well, I'm afraid you're right, but I don't think the average Christian understands that his leaders have, in many instances, been co-opted because they've been promised prosperity, and many of them have been made very prosperous. I mean, they've had great mega churches with tens of thousands of people attending those churches and huge salaries, and they get regular telephone conversations with the White House, and they're part of an elite group that is leading the world towards a better world.
Could I share something with you, Dr. Stan,
you
that's very
right
frightening that I discovered in reviewing materials? These folks honestly thought they were going to pull this thing off in the early 1980s. And they had ducks in a row, and they were having the meetings and the conferences and the organizations, and they were diligently putting the pieces in place, and they were confident that nobody could discover them because they thought that only an initiate could understand them. But I, perusing my library looking for something else the other day, I stumbled upon a book that I've had for a very long time and I'd almost forgotten about, called World Face and the New World Order, A Muslim Jewish Christian Search Begins. But they went far beyond those three. And it was sponsored by the Interreligious Peace Colloquium in Lisbon, 7-11, November 1977. Now, those that have studied the New Agers know that Benjamin Krem said, since July 19th, 1977, the Christ has been among us. Interestingly enough, I believe that's the day that Javier Solana, some of his biographical pieces said that's the day he took his seat in the Spanish Parliament. It might be a coincidence, I don't know. But I was looking at the participants, and I was struck by the names, even back that early, that are some of the same names that we're looking at now. And most prominently, they were talking about some of the officers on this. They said Cyrus Vance was vice president until 1977, until he became Secretary of State with President Carter's. Members of the board are Simeon Adebo, Irwin Blank, and then Theodore Hesburgh, who was on board for about everything New Age there was. He was a Catholic who had a Notre Dame University. Philip Klutznik, Sal Leinowitz, Muhammad Abdul-Rauf, Henry Schultz, and then a name that we all know that's still active, Maurice Strong. Or Morris Strong, as it's sometimes pronounced.
Good old, he's one of the three authors of the Earth Charter.
Yes, he is. He's one of the authors of the Earth Charter. And they were doing the same things then, but there was something that was so chilling and so horrifying in this book. And to let you know the mindset of this, they were talking about the using religion too. In fact, that's what this conference was about. And this conference was just very shortly after the time they thought that the new Christ had launched his career, whoever it was, the one they thought they would trot out in 1982. But internalizing a religious perspective, and then there was they talked about how they could use religion, but they said, in addition to this, religious spokespeople may actually play a regressive role in social issues. For instance, on the status of women, a grotesque interaction of secular and religious sensibilities occurred in Somalia 2 years ago. That would have been 1975. So the government sought to emancipate women from various forms of bondage and was opposed by traditionalist religious leaders citing the Quran as their authority. To demonstrate that it meant business, the government rounded up 11 religious leaders actively working against equality for women one morning and executed them later the same day. And basically, the theme of this, it was very obvious that they were suggesting that maybe we should go and do likewise to other religious folks that are getting in our way.
Well, I'm sure that day will come in the not-too-distant future, although the average Christian in America couldn't believe that could ever happen here. And I would ask, if God is just, why couldn't it happen here?
Yeah. Well, it could happen, and it could happen fast, but here this was, they were discussing at that open. Now, I had a huge collection of books, and I had said back then, these folks intend a bloodbath for us, and they still do, but they were talking about it not that subtly then. And then, of course, nobody, a lot of people don't read. Many people are intellectually lazy, and it, maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's the way we were taught to read, because there is the method of reading was changed from syllable recognition to whole word recognition by progressive educators back or after the turn of the century, around the 20s. And looking at that movement, an amazing amount, number of them were theosophists that had hoped to usher in Krishnamurti. And basically, they wanted to change the way we digested things. They wanted us to switch from our analytical left brain to our spiritual, intuitive, artistic right brain. And basically, I think by switching the way we read, may have changed the coding on many of us to perceive and read as by picture recognition, rather than reading. And the older you get, the harder that gets. And when I heard some talk about that, I kind of put folks that talked about that way in the category of assorted cranks, and I thought it didn't make a bit of difference. I've always been able to attack a word and had excellent reading skills, but I forced myself to change the method I read, and I was amazed. I was digesting many times more in a much, much shorter period of time, and it wasn't that Evelyn Wood thing that we look at a page and just try to get the gist of it and don't worry about what order the words are in. Of course the order the words are in is important. But I'm wondering if we weren't handicapped because people detail this thing. It's detailed over and over and over in their books, and yet there were evangelical people going out there telling people to go back to sleep, that nothing was happening, that if it had been happening, that would prove they'd all been asleep at the switch, but they were aware of no such movement happening. That was actually said on a radio interview to follow up by the head of the William Tyndale College, the formerly the Detroit College Bible College, in 1982, immediately after, just not too long after those ads had ran. And people were told to go back to sleep, and it wasn't happening, and so many people went back to sleep, and of course the New Agers being exposed, God was not going to let it happen until folks were ready, and folks were fully warned. But I'm amazed at how many of the same players are out there right now, the same people I wrote about in Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, most of them still around, like Barbara Marx Hubbard, Maurice Strong, and there's Marilyn Ferguson. They're still in the game. They're all older. They're much longer in the tooth, and this thing is going to happen, and they're determined this time. It's not going to stop. Marilyn Ferguson wrote a new book, and she called this one Aquarius Now. And basically, they're on the march again. They're calling themselves different names, different things, including New Agers. But these days, they like to say radical middle, the new cultural creatives. They give themselves lots of names, lots of labels.
Hold that thought. All right, Constance, you got 3 minutes to wrap up this story.
Dr. Stan, there's always so much. There's so much. There's we're in some very serious times, and the pace is quickening. Interestingly, and it may be significant, may not, but a 7-year treaty between the European Union, it was a reconfirmation of an existing treaty, the Barcelona Treaty, and this one's called European Neighborhood Policy. And it went into effect January 1st of 2007. And it's a 7-year plan that's to run through the end of 2013. And it's up for a 3.5-year review in 2010. And as there are some people that think this may well be the 70th week of Daniel, I don't know if it is or if it isn't. But when I get questions from Israel looking at things and suspecting, and from Jews that aren't Christians suspecting maybe that this is the 70th week of Daniel, and looking at it from their perspective, and looking at these other things, and looking at the intensity and boldness of these folks, and considering that the word has gone out worldwide on this dangers. We may be very close to these times, and if we are, it's not time it's time really to make our peace with God immediately. Do not delay.
I agree with you. In fact, I take Cher magazine. I've been taking it for about 20 years, because it's put out by Benjamin Krem. And for the first time this last issue, they've changed. They've always been the time will come when, of course, the world leader will surface. And this one said the world leader is about to surface. Now everything is placed. His work is done. He is ready to come forward. And this is the first time in all the 20 years I've read that you have this feeling of urgency on their part that we are on the verge of great changes.
Yes. It's very interesting, because if God is ready, it can't happen until God's ready, but if God is ready, we had better be.
Amen to that. And I really fear that we're moving into a major crisis in the Middle East. I'm very, very concerned about the future of Israel. I'm concerned about the future of our society.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate everything you do, Constance, and we'll look forward to talking to you again tomorrow, and as we begin to pre-record some programs for our weekend program, and as you know, that we actually do 3 audiences during the week, and then we'll do our weekend program tomorrow. Anyway, God bless.
Thanks so much, Dr. Stan. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for staying up here so late.
Thank you.
Good night. God bless. Well, I hope our listeners enjoyed Constance Covey. And you have to understand, she's talking about a Luciferian movement. This is what the New Age is really all about. This is what the Constance consciousness is, a cosmic consciousness, contact with Lucifer himself. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners, first of all, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help to continue doing what we're doing, and hopefully one day to be able to expand our network. But right now, we want to maintain what we have, almost 60 outlets every single week. Some of those are shortwave, internet, satellite. But, of course, we're reaching people maybe just half an hour a week. But at least they're going to hear the truth that they'd never hear otherwise. Understanding we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. We do still have a few copies of Constance Cumby's classic book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, the book that changed my life back 30 30 years ago, 1982. That's what, 25 years ago. But we are also hoping, and Constance talked to me tonight about getting the book back in print. And if you're interested in getting a pre-publication case of her book, under the same status as when we actually published my own books, before we offered a case of books, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. There'll be only a fraction of what the retail cost would be. And this book is increasingly hard to get. As they say, we have the last few. You can still get a copy of the book by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. The book is called The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, and it was the first revelation within the Christian community of this vast network with countless millions of people in the United States who worship a different God, and the first realization that there are two gods. There's the God that the Christian worship and the other God that is there. A very real force, a powerful force that motivates some of the most powerful and influential people in America today. And then, of course, you begin getting into all the organizations we speak of regularly, the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, Club of Rome. These are all simply front organizations for the true occult forces and occult ruler of the world today. So certainly if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get that and read it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, because it will begin to put things into perspective. You'll certainly want to get Constance Cumby's The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. You want to get my talk on World Revolution, because it actually contains my interview in 1980 with Ambassador Smith, who was at Cuba at the time. The United States government turned Cuba over to a known communist. We knew Fidel Castro was a communist. We've kept him in power ever since then. And they laugh at how stupid the American people are to think that the elite consider him an enemy. If you doubt that the elite do not consider him an enemy, you need to get David Rockefeller's memoirs, which are available from Radio Liberty. David Rockefeller, the most powerful and wealthy man in the United States today, talking about how his daughter is such a good friend of Fidel Castro. Why would the daughter of one of the most powerful capitalists in the world be a good friend of the wicked Fidel Castro? Because they don't look upon him as wicked either at all. This is all a scam. You need to get the book Foundations, The Power and Influence, to find out how the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation have financed communism here in the United States for almost a century. Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. The book is Foundations, Their Power and Influence. We kept it in print. Professor Quigley's wonderful book, The Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Times, points out how all these crazy right-wingers really thought the enemy was communism. And it never was communism. The enemy was this group of people. Professor Quigley, who wrote the book, didn't figure that they were the enemy. They were the hope of the world, this elite group who wanted, of course, to use the threat of communism to distract us so we would not understand what their real game was. What was their purpose and goal? Why, they were going to bring the kingdom of God to earth. Understand, we're in a spiritual battle. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and we'll be back here in just a moment with another exciting program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. But we ask you not to hold your calls unless we ask for them, or until we ask for them, because right now we have on the line from WorldNet Daily, Andrew Skousen. Hi there. How are you doing, Andrew?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. A pleasure to be with you.
I'm so glad you're with us again tonight. Well, certainly you're going to be giving us the material from World Affairs Brief, so why don't you tell us what's going on in the world?
You bet. Absolutely, Dr. Stan. Well, this week's brief has quite a bit of fantastic stories in it. I've also got the brand new brief that's hot off the press that was just delivered to people's email inboxes today. So yeah, this is going to be a good story here. Let me start off with the U.S.'s evidence about Iran.
All right, Vladimir, because the president is trying to convince us that the Iran is arming the Iraqis who are killing our boys, and Iran is providing all these weapons that are being used to kill our boys, and of course, there are a lot of people back in Washington, D.C. are very skeptical. They think this is simply being used as a justification for a war with Iran.
That's right. Exactly, and it's not quite clear. It hasn't fully materialize into an all-out justification for a war on Iran and a future coming attack. But if you have to analyze the information that the U.S. is pulling up about Iran, it increasingly becomes suspicious that they are working really hard to create a case against Iran, much as they were doing against Iraq before the current war in Iraq that we are experiencing now. One of the largest points that the administration is making lately has to do with the Iran support, or so-called support, of all of the Iraqi insurgents right now. And so there's been a great deal of examples. For instance, they used recently the United States officials in Baghdad put a show on about all of the Iranian-made weapons that they came into possession of. There was a very large display of captured intelligence that the Americans proudly showed off, showing Iranian-made weapons to reporters. Most of the examples that they showed reporters were smuggled weapons that were put on displays, including explosive formed projectiles, 81 millimeter mortar shells, which are used as roadside bombs, rocket propelled grenades, etc. All of these explosive devices that the U.S. claims can be traced back to Iran. Interestingly enough, though, the weapons had characteristics that the U.S. claimed were unique to being manufactured in Iran, but there are some suspicious aspects about what the U.S. showed off to reporters that Kurt Nemo actually pointed out recently. He said that some of the dates on the shells show them as being manufactured as recently as last year. But Iran...
Hold on, though. We'll be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. All right, you were saying that some of these weapons were just manufactured last year.
That's right. That's right. And not just last year, but many of the weapons were manufactured in sources that can't be that couldn't be manufactured in Iran. For instance, Iran doesn't have the capability to manufacture 81 millimeter mortar rounds. The article, as reported by Kurt Nemo, points out a very interesting item. He says that the people at the Pentagon fail to explain why the Iranians in these weapons manufactured in Iran used a date from the Christian Gregorian calendar, he says, and not from the Islamic Persian calendar. According to the Muslim calendar, the date stenciled on the mortar shells should have read 1427, not 2006. And also, oddly enough, why did Iran, a country speaking and writing in Persian, a language written, which is a written version of the Arabic script, why would they decide to label their shells in English? It's quite odd. One of the other points of evidence that the U.S. has recently brought up to point to Iran manufacturing or at least smuggling weapons into insurgents in Iraq is the item of 50 caliber sniper rifles. Obviously, these are very dangerous weapons to have in the hands of insurgents, since they can use these very powerful weapons, which have armor-piercing rounds, which fire quite accurately from long distances. U.S. intelligence claims that they have found these spare 50 rifles in insurgent weapons caches. But it's important to look at which insurgents these are found in. There are multiple insurgents in Iraq. There are the Shia insurgents, the Sunni insurgents, and the U.S.-controlled al-Qaeda insurgents. Now, it makes quite a bit of difference which group possessed this cache of weapons. The U.S., of course, doesn't explain which ones it found it in. If they were Sunni insurgents, which is the vast majority of insurgents, Sunnis are enemies of Iran as well, and would hardly be recipients of Iran's benefits.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew was simply pointing out that these roadside devices, they're 81-millimeter mortar shells that they claim, the government claims, were manufactured in Iran, and of course, but the problem is that they are dated, and the dating is not in the Persian or the Arabic, as you would anticipate, it's in English. Why would the Persians be, the Iranians be, putting a date on their weapons in English? Almost sounds like maybe they were manufactured somewhere in the Western world rather than Iran. And then, of course, they're talking about the sniper rifles that have been found among the insurgents, but they never tell us which insurgents. There are three groups of insurgents. One is the Shia insurgents, a rather small insurgency group. Now, this has nothing to do with the militias and the civil war going on. These are the insurgents who are attacking Americans. The largest group of the insurgents are Sunnis, and of course they're the ones who are attacking our forces. And then there's the Al-Qaeda, which of course Andrew is suggesting that some of these Al-Qaeda forces, as Al-Qaeda has always been, seem to be U.S. controlled. Now, question is, which one has the 50 caliber sniper rifles, which supposedly had been sold to Iran and then transferred to the insurgents? So you pick up the story there, Andrew.
That's right. Well, it's not clear. The U.S. actually doesn't say which group of insurgents had the rifles, but it doesn't make much sense that any three of them would have had them if the rifles truly had come from Iran. And that is as you pointed out, the Shia insurgents is a small group. The largest group are the Sunnis, but they aren't friends with Iran. In fact, they are open enemies of Iran, so Iran would not be shipping weapons to that group. If it is Shia, in fact, the U.S. is the largest provider of weapons to this group, and that's both open and covert. Quan Coyle writes about the figures concerning U.S. deaths, attributed by implication of location in Baghdad to Shia. This is false, says Juan. He quotes a New York Times article that says that he says depends on unnamed U.S. government sources who allege that 25% of U.S. military deaths and woundings in Iraq in October through December 2006 were from EFP bombs, which are modified mortar shell bombs, fashioned in Iran and given to Shiite militias. He says this claim can't be right because 25% of U.S. troops were not killed fighting Shiites in those 3 months. Day after day, the casualty reports specify the Al-Anbar province, the Diyala province, the Suladin province, or Babil. Baghdad districts such as Al-Dura, Ghazilaya, Amaraya, etc., are all fighting Sunni Arab guerrillas. And Iran is not giving high-tech weapons to Ba'athists and Shiite killers. In other words, it's not giving them to Sunnis and anti-Shiites. He says it is true that some casualties were in East Baghdad, and that Baghdad is beginning to rival Al-Anbar as a cemetery for U.S. troops. He says overall, only a fourth of U.S. troops had been killed in Baghdad through the end of 2006. But U.S. troops aren't fighting Shiites anywhere else, in Nineveh, in Dayalah, Salahuddin. These are all Sunni areas. For a fourth of U.S. troops to be being killed or wounded by Shiite explosive mortars, all of the Baghdad deaths would have passed us in the hands of Shiites. So it just doesn't add up quite right. Over 800 of the 50 caliber armor piercing rifles were exported from Austria to Iran in 2005. The U.S. claims that over 100 of these have made their way into insurgent hands and can be traced back through Iran. Seems fair enough. And yet this is far from being positive proof. And it's important to analyze the evidence, particularly the claims from our own government that has been known to manufacture evidence and weapons with fake markings on them to cast blame on countries that it is trying to attack. As for the rifles, we would have to know where these rifles were exported and if the U.S. or Britain covertly brought them into Iraq to blame Iran. Even if the U.S. did provide serial numbers from the Austrian company, which they haven't done, it's still not positive proof that the U.S. Couldn't order a special set of rifles to match what was sent to Iran. Taylor Mash has further commentary about the effects of U.S. Modifying information to try to fit its own story, and yet it doesn't quite match up. He talks about the same idea about U.S. claiming arms going to certain groups and how it doesn't quite add up. He quotes a defense analyst who said that Iran was working through multiple surrogates, including mostly rogue elements of the Shiite Mahdi army, to smuggle explosive forms projectiles, the mortars used as roadside bombs, into Iraq. He said most of the components are entering the country at crossing points near the Iranian border city of Mehran, and that the evidence against Iran and and the Mahdi army continues to pile up. He starts to pick it apart here, though. He says, the administration claims that Iranians caught in recent raids buttress claims of Iranian involvement. The targets of American ire appear to be Iran and the Mahdi army. However, the Iranians were captured in Kurdish-held Erbil and in Abdulaziz al-Hakim's compound in Baghdad. In both these instances, the Iranians captured were actually working with American allies in Iraq, namely the Kurds and the Siri, not with the Mahdi army. The Bush administration has indeed made a fine bed with terrorists in Iraq. There is very little doubt that Iran is supporting the Shia factions and the Kurds in Iraq. However, the factions Iran is supporting are the same factions that the Bush administration is supporting. The Shia faction that gets the least support from Iran, and that is ideologically the least aligned with Iran, is in fact the Mahdi army. Yet the administration's plan, as laid out in the Bush administration's memo, appears to isolate the Mahdi army and empower the various factions, Saleh and Siri, that Iran has been helping. So the administration is kind of spinning a story about Iran that is full of contradictions. The Bush administration can't claim to target Iran for arming the same groups as the United States itself is arming, without, of course, addressing its own behavior and its own alliances in Iraq. And it's been clear from the start that the United States has put power terrorists and thugs, namely Daleh and Siri, in power in Iraq. So to support its drumbeats to war against Iran, it cannot not now cry foul without addressing its own hypocrisy.
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting that, certainly we are 47 months now we've been in Iraq. Now, one of the major forces there is the Mahdi army, which is controlled by this cleric with a black turban, who is violently un-American. If this man is really violently un-American, why have we tolerated his army there for 47 months? Only recently are we told that we're beginning to crack down on him. Why did we wait 47 months to go after this armed militia group that has been there killing and killing Sunnis? There's something terribly wrong with this entire story. And now, of course, apparently they're telling us that the man who leads this, the sheikh with the black turban, is living in Iran. We don't know where he is, but this story really doesn't ring true. In fact, certainly this man sits on the parliament that we put in power in Iraq, and a lot of his followers are there, and they are the major backers of the Maliki government that we're backing. So there's a lot of inconsistencies in this story.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the United States over the last 4 years has been arming precisely the same militias that support the controlled Iraqi interior ministry, namely the Siri and the Badr brigades, and they're some of the worst thugs out there.
And they're real killers. And so we've been arming, we've been training them. Why would we be doing that after 47 months? And now, only now, are we suddenly saying, hey, these are bad guys. I got to tell them that, about 40 months ago.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Now, that's talking about the evidence that is going back and forth between the insurgents in Iraq and the U.S. intelligence trying to point the finger at Iran. What's interesting here, I'd kind of like to launch into the next story in the brief, which talks about, it's a short story about four brief wars that are actually going on in Iraq. One of the commentaries, Philip Carter, says that he can distinguish between four main wars that are currently being fought in Iraq.
All right,
not
fine.
Just one civil war.
All right, fine. Well, then you hold that thought, and then we're going to bring all of our listeners on with us, and we'll talk about the four wars that are being fought at the present time there in Iraq. So hold that thought. We'll be right back with Andrew Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Andrew's talking about four separate wars, really. So you pick the story up there.
All right. This is from commentator Philip Carter, who quotes Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who says that our strategic stagnation results from the fact that we are fighting four wars, not one. According to Gates, one is Shia on Shia, principally in the south. The second is sectarian conflict, principally in Baghdad, but not completely. Third is the Sunni insurgency, and fourth is Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is attacking at times all of these targets. So the multifaceted nature of these four wars, he says, has frustrated American strategy since 2003. And he's probably right. Successes in one area produce setbacks in the other, with Al-Qaeda, according to him, hovering above the fray to spoil progress whenever it threatens to bring stability. For instance, he quotes the bombing of the Al-Askari Mosque in Samarra back in February of last year. What Carter doesn't realize, however, is that, as we point out in multiple stories throughout in the World Affairs Brief, Al-Qaeda, at least at the top, is a controlled U.S.-British black operation. We've documented multiple times where all of the key people that have been pointed out to control Al-Qaeda have had ties in the past to either U.S. or British black operations, CIA, etc. These top controllers at Al-Qaeda purposely continue to provoke these conflicts in Iraq so as to justify the continued U.S. occupation.
And because this is the reason we never got Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda, when, of course, we had our troops there and they were trapped in the Tora Bora Mountains in December of 2001, is because we didn't want to get them. After all, we'd had a lot of money invested in Al-Qaeda. We'd been financing the Taliban, who'd been giving sanctuary to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Why would we have been financing it before 9/11, when, of course, they were supposedly our enemy? But this is all a matter of perception. So the leaders of Al-Qaeda, many of them, of course, are certainly working with the Central Intelligence Agency, one of the finest enemies money could buy. Pick the story up there.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. One example of U.S.-controlled provocation is actually the attack on the mosque in Samarra. There was some information that this operation was carried out by security forces that were controlled by the U.S., who stood guard around the mosque for 4 hours. While U.S. mercenary explosive experts were inside
You're speaking now of the Golden Mosque that President Bush addressed in his one of his recent speeches, saying how terrible it was that they'd blown up this old mosque, one of the most holy places in the Shia religion, and yet, there's no question at all that nobody could have gotten in there without the full support of our forces. I mean, there were guards there, and the guards were not protecting the mosque. They were keeping people out while they placed the explosives there. So pick the story up.
That's absolutely right, Dr. Stan. And that's not the only situation. There's been instances of innocent Iraqis who've been sent off in a car, which later explodes, and they call it a suicide bomb when it's in fact a remote control explosion. There's multiple instances of people documenting the U.S. These kinds of conflicts, and I'm sure that many more will surface, especially in Iraq. But it is our opinion that the war in Iraq is not set to be calmed down. That in fact the Bush administration or the U.S. forces there are actively working to make sure that things don't settle down, and it's certainly working well. I'd like to switch gears now. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Border Patrol and about the administration, the Bush administration's campaign to actually intimidate our Border Patrol agencies to do their job less effectively. I imagine you've heard some things about this. Dr. Sam?
Yes, so you're talking about Ramos and Kappas, the two Border Patrol officers who were sent to prison because they had tried to apprehend this this drug smuggler who had come across the border and scuffled with him and was running away. And, of course, they thought he turned around. They thought he had a weapon. They fired at him, and he kept right on running and, of course, disappeared. And so we don't know whether he had a weapon or not, but under any circumstances, the supervisors came down, they found the shells that had been fired, but the two men were instructed not to file a written report by their supervisors. There were something like 11 members of the Border Patrol who were there who knew all about this. And yet, of course, charges were brought against them by the federal attorney in that area, a very close friend of Alberto Gonzalez, a man named Sutton. And instead of going after the drug smuggler, they went after the border agents, which has totally demoralized the Border Patrol. In other words, you try to do your job, you try to stop the drug smugglers, why, of course, you're going to go to prison.
That's exactly right. The World Affairs Brief recently interviewed one of the investigators that is part of the Department of Homeland Security, who's been working to investigate these kind of situations on behalf of the Border Patrol agents, and he volunteered that that morale in the U.S. Border Patrol has hit rock bottom recently. Most of the good agents there feel as they are kind of in a legal limbo because they are. It seems that they are prosecuted for even the most minor violations of procedures, while the illegals who are constantly threatening them with bodily injury are given immunity at the drop of a hat and then given the opportunity to testify against them. Many of the Border Patrol agents, this investigator said, are just planning on getting out, which is, of course, going to leave most of the worst unprincipled or worse yet, yes men, people behind. And it's probably not a surprise then that there was a recent study of all of the government departments surveyed, employee satisfaction was the lowest at the Department of Homeland Security. But let's go through a couple of stories, because there are several of these stories out here, and these will show some of what these Border Patrol agents are experiencing, and more than that, it shows that the problems that they are facing actually comes from the supervisory level of the Border Patrol agency itself, which is of course coordinated with U.S. attorneys and prosecuting attorneys who are directing the evidence against these people and the prosecution of the agents. It has to be tied together, as you'll see in the following stories.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a break here, and of course, when we get back, we'll try to cover more of this for you. The problem that we face today is that the president and the current Bush administration has no intention of enforcing our border laws because their loyalty is not to the United States, to our Constitution, but to this international dream. First of all, creating a North American Union where the America loses its sovereignty and its prosperity, and then, of course, the people lose their freedom, then merging us into this world government. And this is part of a long-range plan that, of course, is being carried out not only here but throughout the world today. We'll be right back with Andrew Skousen. Well, Andrew, go ahead and pick the story up.
All right. This next story is one of the examples about the Border Patrol agents who are unnecessarily prosecuted, and it's from Fox News, and they document an incident that happened several weeks ago where a Border Patrol agent tried to arrest 7 illegal agents near Naco, Arizona. The agent apparently had 3 immigrants inside a vehicle and 3 on the ground, but one of them, Francisco Rivera, refused to comply, the agent said. He apparently picked up a rock as large as 5 pounds and pulled his arm back to throw it from about 10 feet away. The agent, a former Marine, says he killed Rivera with a single shot when he failed to answer commands to put the rock down. Just as a background, rock throwing at agents is quite common at both agents physically and their vehicles, and it's a fairly common tactic that illegals use to cause agents to retreat so that they can run and evade capture. The local Border Patrol union, who is defending the agent, claims self-defense and fears that the agent is about to be railroaded after, get this, Mexican officials were given unrestricted access to the witnesses before U.S. investigators were.
That was basically they were going to coach them then of what to say, and these people would lie. Of course, they would be told to lie by their government because they want to make an example of any officer, any American officer, who's trying to defend himself or do a good job. Would that be a fair statement?
Exactly. In fact, the investigator that that the World Affairs Brief interviewed said that the Border Patrol supervisor, a certain Darcy Olmos, brought in Mexican officials to coach the witnesses, and that this Mexican official is a Latino woman who is a very pro illegal immigration person.
Now, why would they have a pro illegal immigration supervisor working for the Border Patrol unless of course they were trying to demoralize the Border Patrol and keep them from doing their job?
Indeed. And so, in this case, the Mexican consulate was allowed to coach the witnesses, said Brandon Tubb, the president of the union that's defending this agent.
Before American officials could question
them. Before American officials, that's
right. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Andrew Skousen. He's simply talking about another unfortunate Border Patrol officer who was apprehending 7 illegal immigrants, and one of them refused to comply with his demand to lay down, and he took a big rock, a 5-pound rock, was going to throw it, and from 10 feet away he would have done a lot of harm, and so the officer simply did what he had to do. He shot him and killed him. And then, of course, instead of allowing the U.S. officials to come in and question the other people, the other immigrants who were there, the illegal immigrants, they brought in the Mexican officials to coach the people before the American officials could even talk to them. In other words, this is going to be another setup. They're going to send this man to prison as well. So the lesson is very, very clear. You do your job. You try to apprehend people at the border. Why, you're going to go to prison. You may even be indicted for murder. So pick the story up.
That's right. So just to polish off the story, the agent is now in jeopardy because all of these witnesses, after being coached to solidify their stories by the Mexican consulate, they all claim that the dead man did not have a rock and that he wasn't intending to throw it, and they've all got the same story now. But it's a poor situation for the Border Patrol agent who is doing his best against 7 other people to protect our nation's borders. But this is just one small case. There are witnesses. This investigator that we interviewed told us of a specific case where he was personally involved in, where a Mexican military group had crossed over into the U.S. to protect a drug shipment. They were sighted by a Border Patrol agent who called in for reinforcements. But the agent was surrounded by the Mexicans who had AK-47 assault rifles. He was forced to exit his vehicle and lay on the ground. Border Patrol reinforcements arrived, and the Mexican military fired several shots at the approaching vehicle, and a firefight ensued. The Mexicans left, but they were taken into custody and jailed. The investigator was present when a high-level supervisor called and ordered them, get this, to free the Mexicans, escort them back to the border, and return all of their weapons. And apparently this isn't an isolated occurrence. These military incursions go on all the time, this investigator told us, and the U.S. government keeps covering for them. He says that there are hundreds of documented attacks on Border Patrol agents each year, and yet, for all of Bush's threatenings about other countries on the other side of the world attacking our liberties, so-called, our government doesn't seem very anxious to confront Mexico about its ongoing military incursion into the U.S. Kevin Mooney of CS News wrote that gun-toting members of the Mexican military are crossing regularly into U.S. territory. They are partnering with drug cartels, criminal gangs, to protect sophisticated smuggling operations, according to Texas sheriff and lawmaker. And as illustrated by the story that the investigator is telling us, our government is complicit in this cover-up. Apparently, more than 200 incursions by the Mexican military of the U.S. southern border has been documented since the late 1990s. This is according to Representative Ted Poe, a Republican from Texas. He said in an interview that our federal government denied it occurred until the Texas sheriff started to take photos. There is no nation in the world that would allow this invasion to occur except for the United States, and the Representative Poe quote. Seems in this case that the only people that are being prosecuted here are the good guys. You mentioned, Dr. Stan, U.S. Attorney John Sutton. This is the attorney who oversees federal prosecutions in West and South Texas. He has an office in San Antonio. As far as we can tell, he is kind of the point man and is deeply involved in the cover-ups. There is a situation that's now known as the House of Death. There was a mass murder case where a dozen drug informants had been lured to a house and were all mass killed in the garden of this house. But there was quite a cover up of what went on there, and it, all the way up to the top of the DEA and the Department of Justice.
Well, apparently what I've actually heard was that they're at this so-called House of Death, where they were actually killing many times DEA agents, where people who were actually other DEA agents were implanted there within the drug smuggling operation, who actually supervised the killing of other American drug agents, and this whole thing had to be covered up. They couldn't let the American people know that our own undercover agents were actually killing American undercover agents. I mean, the whole story is so incredible. This is the story of the House of Death, and the fact that most Americans have never heard of it is, well, go ahead, Andrew.
Well, it's true, and Americans should hear about this. I mean, people would be incensed if they found out that the good side of the Drug Enforcement Administration that is working hard to put people undercover in to track down drug cartels and drug lords are being undermined by their own fellow officers at times on the dark side of the DEA, they would be absolutely incensed. But of course, they can't bring these kinds of cases to light because it starts to draw dangerous questions. For instance, why is the U.S. trying to, why did this happen? And it points to the fact that the U.S. is complicit with some of the drug lords. It appears that a lot of the money for CIA dark operations comes through drug smuggling and a combination with certain drug lords. And when the good side of the DEA starts to try to inform and bring information on these drug lords that are in bed with the CIA, they have to be taken out. The only drug lords that the U.S. actually goes after are those that are in competition to the ones that that we're in league with.
I mean, the whole story is really so incredible. It's almost as incredible as the documented story about the chief torturer for the Irish Republican Army in Ireland. Now, the number two man in the Irish Republican Army, and the chief torturer for the Irish Republican Army, he was the man, of course, would kill and the people who were suspected of being infiltrators into the IRA. The only trouble is that the number two man and the chief torturer are both British intelligence agents, posing as members of the IRA. And, of course, I mean, this is incredible. I mean, the entire Irish Republican Army organization was actually controlled largely by British intelligence, MI6. And we find here now, certainly within this House of Death, the story of this massive drug smuggling operation, pretty well controlled in many respects by undercover DEA agents who are killing other DEA agents so they can maintain their cover. This is rather scary, this going on in America today. Sounds like what went on in Ireland for so many years.
That's right. One of the dark side agents who was part of this plot was found out and reported on, and apparently the matter even reached headquarters in Washington. The information went up the chain of command, eventually reaching America's Deputy Assistant Attorney General, John G. Malcolm. But it also passed through the office of, once again, Johnny Sutton, the U.S. Attorney for Western Texas, which, by the way, is a close associate of George W. Bush. When Bush was Texas Governor, Sutton spent 5 years as his Director of Criminal Justice Policy. After Bush became President, Sutton became Legal Policy Coordinator in the White House Transition Team. He also worked with another Bush, Texas colleague, Alberto Gonzalez, the present U.S. Attorney General.
And then he became the local federal prosecutor, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he's actually behind the prosecution of the now famous Border Patrol agents Ramos and Compeon, whose case, of course, I think most people are familiar with. But a couple of highlights about that case. Sutton has been making regular appearances on TV justifying the trumped-up case against the two agents, stating incorrectly that the smuggler was, quote, shot in the back. Sutton knows, however, that the forensic evidence proves that the smuggler was shot from the side. New evidence has just come to light that the government falsified the evidence to convict the two faithful agents and lied to Congress during the recent investigation.
And they withheld evidence that would have exonerated them, intentionally withheld evidence, which is a crime in itself. And so you have the federal prosecutor guilty of a criminal activity and then allowed to go on television across America to justify sending two innocent Border Patrol officers to prison, which has totally demoralized the Border Patrol.
It does. And yet the story goes deeper than that. The two U.S. Border Patrol agents were convicted of firing upon and hitting admitted drug smuggler Osvaldo Aldrete Davila while he was in the process of smuggling no less than 743 pounds of marijuana across the border. Aldrete was given immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying against the U.S. Border Patrol agents. Apparently, Skinner is reported to have said that his Department of Homeland Security agents had, quote-unquote, misinformed Congress. The Department of Homeland Security's actions represent a complete obstruction of justice, and the Border Patrol agent's conviction should be immediately overturned, and the agents who supplied the bogus testimony should be prosecuted with the full force of the law. But that's not all of it yet. I mean, WorldNet Daily reporter Jerome Corsi says that the documents that were kept from Congress reveal that one of the Department of Homeland Security investigators, Christopher Sanchez, was a longtime friend of this smuggler, and that Sanchez went far beyond what was appropriate for law enforcement in handling a criminal so-called victim. Sanchez gave his smuggler friend immunity to come back to the U.S. and testify against the agent. He also arranged free medical treatment at a U.S. military medical treatment center. He let the smuggler friend stay overnight at a house. Worst of all, he gave him a green card without expiration so he could continue to smuggle by legally crossing the border.
In fact, he did get caught again smuggling drugs, and they let him off the second time.
That's right. In 2005, he was busted again for a large shipment, which he brought across the border with the green card. Sanchez has been referred to by some as the smuggler's quote-unquote handler, and that's probably not far off. Given the extreme preferential and illegal circumstances, there's a high probability that the smuggler was part of the CIA smuggling network, and it explains his rehabilitation and continued work that was so facilitated by dark side agents like Sanchez. So this case worked out well. It both picked a victim to justify railroading Ramos and Campion into prison, and they also were able to pick somebody to one of their own to help. Unfortunately for the poor Border Patrol agents, the story doesn't end there for them. Neither was allowed to remain free while their appeal was pending. They were sent to prison. They were supposed to be kept isolated from the general prison population, obviously for their own safety, while their appeals were pending. There are in our prison systems numerous violent, illegal aliens in prison that obviously represent a clear threat to any Border Patrol agent who might be caught in the same circumstances. Agent Ramos was not kept isolated as promised.
In fact, they moved him away from where his family is, where a minimum security, to a medium security in another state in Mississippi, so his family can't get to see him on a regular basis. They're doing, of course, is making examples of these men, violating the prison's own laws. When this man, the officer, was attacked, the prison authorities refused to come to his aid or his defense. He can't get medical help. I mean, think of the message this is sending to everybody in the Border Patrol. If you do your job, we're going to target you, we're going to get you, we're going to put you in the general prison. We're not even going to let you appeal your case. We're going to send you to prison. I mean, certainly other people are allowed to appeal their cases before they go to prison, but not the Border Patrol agents who are there defending us.
Absolutely. And as the World Affairs Brief has reported before, the prison system is riddled with drugs, probably helped by the U.S. system itself, operated by the dark side of government. Most of the guards are corrupt. They don't protect prisoners that the government wants taken down. Prisoners who are hostile to government for ideological reasons, or who are whistleblowers, are targeted for so-called special treatment and can expect all kinds of ill treatment on behalf of the other inmates at these institutions, as was seen by Agent Ramos, who was beaten and then denied for hours medical treatment. So it's a scary place to be defending our nation's borders these days, and it's no wonder that most of the good people are leaving now.
What's so interesting is so many of the congressmen are asking George Bush to give these officers a pardon, and
a
he
pardon,
refuses
sure.
to do it. And of course, Tony Snow, the president's representative, says, well, everybody's got to obey the law. Well, the president doesn't obey the law. I mean, he says, I will decide which laws I will enforce, which ones I won't. I mean, there's certainly a double standard here. For the president of the United States, and then the courageous men who are trying to defend our border.
Indeed, and this is a situation when the president should invoke the power of indemnification. I don't know where he'd let people go in these extreme situations.
All right, Bud, we're going to be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, Andrew, let's go ahead and get your web page out. How can people get in touch with World Affairs Brief and perhaps get a trial and hopefully want to subscribe and get the weekly update?
All right. That's a fantastic idea. I think the best place for people to find out about the World Affairs Brief is to log on to our website. It's worldaffairsbrief.com. That's one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And there they can click on a link and receive a free copy of the World Affairs Brief sent to their email inbox. They can check it out and see if they like what's on there. They can also call toll-free 1-866. Hold on, I have forgotten the number here for a second. This is embarrassing. I'll have to give that out a little bit later.
All right, go right ahead.
All right, well, we were talking about some various instances with the Border Patrol and how it's being undermined by the administration, and I'd just like to point out that these aren't isolated instances. This policy of prosecuting the Border Patrol agents and consistently helping out the illegal aliens, it's not new, and in fact, it's been going on since at least when Bush took office. The Border Patrol, in fact, last year were given stand down orders when militiamen were patrolling the border and attempting to report illegals to the Border Patrol. Journalist Jerry Stepper of the Washington Times reported that U.S. Border Patrol agents had been ordered not to arrest illegal aliens along the sections of the Arizona border where protesters patrolled last month, because an increase in apprehensions would have proved the effectiveness of Minutemen volunteers. More than a dozen agents, all of whom asked not to be identified for fear of retribution, that's also telling, said orders relayed by Border Patrol supervisors at NACO Arizona Station made it clear that the arrests were not to go up along the 22-mile section of the border that the volunteers monitored to protest illegal immigration. It was clear, they said, to everyone what was being said and why. The apprehensions were not to increase after the Minutemen volunteers left. It was as simple as that.
Well, we're out of time, Andrew. We're going to thank you so much for being with us.
All right.
Look forward to having you with us again. Our guest has been Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Go to their website, get the information. I do it every morning. Good night. God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. A pleasure to be with you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Andrew Skousen, and I hope you enjoyed our discussion of the things that are going on. America's in real trouble. A lot of it doesn't make sense unless you understand that we're only seeing part of the story, because behind everything are powerful spiritual forces that are guiding the destinies of men and of nations. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You can get it in also DVD or VHS form, but you need to get it, you need to read it, you need to study it. And then you need to get the other things that we have that will help you to understand what's really going on. Now, we do have a four-shape stud on immigration. We have a video called The Conquest of Aztlan. We carry Dr. Jerome Corsi's book entitled the Minutemen, which of course goes into the whole background of this effort to create the North American Union and destroy this country. It is a treasonous plan. You need to get, of course, our material on this globalism, these globalistic plans. Anyway, certainly give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and get the 4-tape set on immigration, the DVD on the or VHS on the conquest of Aslan, the book Minuteman, and another book called Fighting Immigration Anarchy. The books are here. The information is here. You need to get it. You need to understand. They're being betrayed by our leaders who have a different view. They have a different vision. They want a new world order and a new world religion. Now, then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get some of the other items that we're carrying. Our 4-tape set on the supernatural. Our 4-tape set on Satanism and deliverance. The 4-tape set on Aleister Crowley, who was the chief Satanist in the United States for the first half of the last century. You want to get the DVDs or the videos? They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. The DVD on Megiddo 1, on Megiddo 2, on the Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And actually, I appear in a couple of these. I don't want you to get them because you want to see me, but we do have a small part in Megiddo 2, in the Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. But you need to understand that there really are secret societies. There are powerful spiritual forces that energize these secret societies. If you have not yet read Constance Cumby's book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, we still have a few copies, but we do hope that many of you would be interested in getting a full case of these at a special discount rate to help us get the book back in print again. We need probably more than ever before to get this book widely distributed, and we have the last supply. The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, and if you'd be interested in getting a case of the books, give us a call. We'll call you back and you get the details of it. It'll pre-publication offer, as we did with my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. So our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you've not yet laid in a supply of emergency foods, don't put it off. Hundreds of you have our health, pardon me, our emergency store catalogs. We are moving towards a climax of history. You better have your water supplies. If you don't have a big Berkey or Berkey Light water purifier, you need to get it. You need to get the pumps and the other materials for water storage. Make your preparations so you can be self-sufficient. You need to have a good supply of health products on hand to keep your health and your immunity up. If we do go into a catastrophic condition here at home, you need to get our 4-tape set on the Military Commission Act, which goes into the planned dictatorship. You need to get our DVD, pardon me, our 4-tape set on concentration camp, or our videos and 4-tape set in the concentration camp special. We're not talking about imaginary things. We're talking about very real things. Please pray for America, pray for revival, and pray for Radio Liberty. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.